Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
All my life, racked with guilt, you know, nightmares, and trying to find my father so I can beg forgiveness for him for causing the death of his wife, thinking that he was probably acting the same way my adoptive mother did when my grandfather died, you see? And they told me, no, she's alive.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 7, Who Let the Dogs Out? Act 1, Back to the Bronx. On June 24th, 1974, just a few weeks after his 21st birthday, David Berkowitz returned to the Bronx following an honorable discharge from 3 years of active service in the U.S. Army, without any idea what he would do next.
I think for every soldier or sailor returning home after years away, and it's a tough re-entry back to civilian life. In the military, things are all clearly defined. The rules are very simple and known, and you know how to act and what to expect from other soldiers. There's a defined pecking order and parameters that spell out what your duties are in every situation, including the chaos of combat. Coming back out, it's sort of a controlled chaos, particularly if you don't have a family that's established and able to help you through some reentry things, because very few people come out of the military and walk right the next day into a good, secure job and relationship and that sort of thing.
After the Army and all that, and you were out on your own, did you try to meet people? Did you try to find a girlfriend, a companion? Did you try to find male friends that you could sit around bullshit?
It's a half-hearted, I made a half-hearted attempt, you know. And every time something wasn't too successful, I'd take it as a personal affront and it would build up my anger, you know.
Were more attempts unsuccessful than successful?
Right, that's definitely, because if they would have been successful, I probably would have been here now, you see. The only reason I became angry and hostile was because I wasn't successful, and it built up, you know.
Once he was back and attempting to assimilate, David tried, but not very hard. And when he was unsuccessful, he gave up immediately, especially when it came to girls. Quote, when I returned home from the Army, I tried to go out with some of the girls in Co-op City. They didn't find me attractive. They had no sexual interest in me, even though they were sexually experienced. I began to hate girls. I always hated them. End quote. Almost as if failure was the desired outcome, David Berkowitz was quick to throw every negative social experience he had on the rage pile in an attempt to collect validation for the anger he felt inside.
He didn't really want a girlfriend because that would have meant going out and interacting with people. He made no effort to join any sort of groups where he could interact with women or with men. He has an incredible fear of rejection, which also kept him from approaching people not only as lovers, but as friends.
So it may come as no surprise that it was around this time, in the summer after his discharge from the Army, that David Berkowitz sensed a sea change within himself, saying later, quote, things began to happen to me and with me. People began to sense something in me. I can't explain it. They were driven from me, end quote. The forces that had always been privately and surreptitiously at work within David Berkowitz were now wildly out of control. But despite everything he was feeling, somehow, David didn't feel there was anything wrong with him. At least not mentally.
You never considered seeking psychiatric help?
Well, I didn't think I really needed any psychiatric help because there was nothing really mentally wrong with me. It's just, which you might call therapy. You know, when I see, when you say psychiatric help, it gives people the impression that, you know, this guy's, he's going crazy. You know, he feels himself going mad or something. That wasn't really the case. It was just that I couldn't properly channel the angers. I think something like a group therapy thing would be better, you know, between adults, a co-ed type group thing where you can discuss all your angers and frustrations openly. That's not really psychiatric help. You see, when you say, well, do you need psychiatric help, it means that the person is starting to flip out. And I think you shouldn't write that.
Okay.
You give people the wrong impression. I admit to going mad, but that's not the case.
David's problems were, according to him, emotional, not mental. And due to that fact, he felt he did not need psychiatric help. Obviously, he did. But I feel like what David is trying to say here is that he wasn't experiencing disorganized thought or hallucinations. He knew where he was and he knew what he was doing. And as it would come up later in court, he understood the difference between right and wrong, at least as far as the law was concerned. But knowing the difference between right and wrong doesn't mean that nothing is wrong. Of course, something was desperately wrong, and he clearly should have sought and would have benefited greatly from psychiatric help. But David Berkowitz wasn't talking to anyone about anything.
Did you have any minister, rabbi, anything like that to you?
No.
You didn't have strong religious feelings one way or the other?
The best person to talk to is someone you feel comfortable with and you can confide in, whether it's your wife, your girlfriend, your best friend, one of your parents, a close uncle, a relative, you see. Not necessarily a psychiatrist.
Unable to engage with any kind of support system whatsoever, David Berkowitz was out on his own, no longer any discernible tether holding him to the earth. David Berkowitz was in orbit.
During David Berkowitz's military time, he was subject to a much greater force, very immediate and forceful if he had stepped too far out of line. He could only get away with so much of the sort of malice he had engaged in through childhood, such as setting fires and stealing, vandalizing equipment and vehicles. Once he's out of the military, he is a boy again. He has no restraints whatsoever and no desire to do anything other than find out more about who he is and why a person like him was put on the earth.
And so, after blasting through the stratosphere at Mach speed, David crash-landed on a lonely planet, devoid of any meaningful connection to others, truly free to spend his time however he wished for the first time in his life. So that's what he did. David Berkowitz returned to his childhood love of arson. In a fire journal discovered by police after his arrest, David meticulously and lovingly jotted down incredibly detailed records of the many fires he claimed to have set during this time period, including date, time, location, and type of fire. He set fires in abandoned lots, abandoned cars, and buildings, etc. In this journal, he claims to have lit 1,411 fires between his return home from the military in 1974 and his arrest in 1977. The number is most likely inflated, but still, he lit a lot of fires.
He was right back where he started before he joined the Army a few years earlier. Only this time, he didn't have his dad there to pay the bills and put a roof over his head. And without a great deal of ambition. He was clueless about life and his purpose in it.
Isolated, alone, and with no support system to speak of, David Berkowitz was going to have to get a job.
My first job was a security guard. I got that about 2 months after I got out of the Army.
What was the name of that outfit?
IBI, Security Company. They're very big. They're all around the United States. It's sort of like a little smaller than Burns, you know. You might even have it up here if you look in a phone book.
IBI?
Yeah. I forgot what it stands for. Investigative Bureau, something like that. But International Bureau of Investigators, maybe. I'm not sure.
And how long were you at that job?
Off and on for about 20 months or so, 2 years.
David started working as a security guard in the summer of 1974 and was assigned to the Universal Car Loading Company outside Kennedy Airport from midnight to 8 a.m. And for those familiar with serial killers, you won't find this at all surprising, although not exactly a feature of serial killer soup, such as arson, head trauma, and animal abuse. An alarmingly high number of serial killers were formerly security guards or held similar positions. And while being a perfectly respectable profession for the vast majority of those who hold the position, it also happens to be a perfect job for a self-labeled, isolated loner. And that, of course, was David in a nutshell. Coworker at the IBI described David as a, quote, heavy, hulking guy who once in a while would smile a Mona Lisa kind of smile, end quote. David had successfully found himself a job, which theoretically meant he could afford an apartment. Good thing, since he had, immediately upon his arrival from Fort Knox, attempted to live with Nat and his new wife. Not too surprisingly, it had not gone well. David was unable to accept his father's new wife and had suspiciously probed her mercilessly and silently whenever he got the chance. Quote, "Nothing missed my inspecting eye. I do have to make it clear, though, that there was nothing of a fetish here. I mean, I never fondled her panties or anything. In fact, after I snooped in her dresser drawers, I immediately washed my hands. My only interest was to check out her personal papers, books, bank books, photos, letters, etc. I did want to ascertain her motive in marrying my dad and to make sure there were no other men in her life. I didn't trust her one bit," end quote. David Berkowitz was focusing his generalized hatred of women on Nat's new wife, and he was dead set on getting her out of the picture by exposing some sort of presumed malfeasance, which he was never quite able to uncover, most likely due to the fact that one didn't exist. And it wasn't just his father's new bride that David found intimidating. Nat's wife had a daughter, just a few years older than David, and she became the new bar to which he would be held. She was everything David was not. Bright and beautiful, she was popular and had a lot of friends. So now, instead of his adoptive mother Pearl, who had showered him with endless love and attention, the position was now filled with not one, but two women who he felt had no use for him, and whom he viewed as threats to him on nearly every level. Due to this, along with everything else, his anger grew toward Nat, toward his stepmother, toward women, and toward the world. Still, David had not fully given up on making something of himself. And in the autumn of 1974, most likely at Nat's urging, enrolled at Bronx Community College, where a fellow student described him as, quote, quiet and friendly. "We used to meet him on the corner. He was good company. He was reliable. Often he would laugh to himself. Berkey used to disappear for a few days at a time, and when you asked him where he went, he said, 'I went for a walk.'" End quote. Another classmate had a different take. Quote, "Sometimes he sat in the back of the room, not participating. More often than not, he was absent." End quote. Acknowledged as an odd duck, to be sure, no one seemed to be fully aware of what was going on inside David's mind as he silently limped in and out of the lives of others, a minor player, relegated to the background and not of much consequence. Unable to make or maintain relationships of his own, he had always, in one way or another, had some sort of shadowy connection to his adoptive father, Nat. But that, unfortunately, was about to change. When in January of 1975, after someone tried to rob the hardware store, Nat had finally had enough, closed down the shop, and moved to Boynton Beach, Florida, with his new wife. Enraged, and in a self-imposed state of isolation and despair, David Berkowitz was now completely alone in New York City. Act 2, the first of three apartments. Around the same time Nat made his exodus to Florida, David moved into his own place, a studio apartment at 2161 Barnes Avenue in the North Bronx, the first of three apartments, which would end up marking his murderous descent into chaos. Although, of course, no one was aware of this. One of his neighbors on Barnes Avenue, who described herself as the quote-unquote mayor of the building, said, quote,
"The day Berkowitz moved in, the door was open, I walked in. His father was in the kitchen. The apartment had a large room and a kitchen. I saw David come in and I wished him good luck. I was told he was a college boy in Bronx Community College. He looked very pleasant and that was it. I saw David many times, whether in the lobby or in the elevator when I was with him. He had a very large laundry bag with him coming or going. Whenever I saw him, he was immaculately dressed. Very clean, a chubby, kind young boy, blue eyes, very good looking, very, very pleasant."
Another tenant in the building saw things differently, describing him as, quote, "in his own world, preoccupied with himself," end quote. Quote, "People think I'm honest, but I'm not. I have an innocent face, but I'm not at all innocent. I must admit, I do love my face. I mean, I can fool anybody with it. It's above suspicion, so to speak. My face, my lips, and my blue eyes are like weapons which I sometimes use to my advantage. I was very aware of its usefulness during my crime spree," end quote. Alone in his apartment, David, unfortunately, spent more time collecting guns than he did reading books. David had acquired an affinity for guns while stationed in South Korea with the U.S. Army, but you can't take them with you when you leave, so he started, casually at first, picking up a few here and there now that he was back. And since it's illegal to own a handgun in New York City, upstanding and law-abiding David Berkowitz started by buying a shotgun. I don't think you'll find it surprising to hear it immediately went bad.
I had lived in the Bronx in an apartment building, and behind me, the super had three Doberman pinschers that he left in the yard from sunrise to sunset, howling and barking unbelievably. I shot one of the dogs with it. I killed it with a shotgun. But you'd figure he'd have taken the hint, you see. He would have taken a hint. He didn't. The next day, two Doberman pinschers were out, and they were just as loud as the three. It didn't even faze the super. It's just how inconsiderate the guy was. Now, there were a lot of complaints against him. Everybody was complaining about the dog, you know?
A neighbor would later say, quote, "I didn't know what to do. Once I called the police about it, but there was nothing they could do. They got many complaints from other neighbors. Berkowitz's window faced the yard," end quote. Berkowitz had owned the 12-gauge Ithaca Deerslayer shotgun only 1 month before he turned it on a living thing. Quote, "I had come under torment. There was constant noise, howling noises, howling, howling. Everybody heard it. I never spoke to anyone about it, but I know everybody heard it. They had to hear it," end quote. David had brought his love for guns home from the military and was now applying them to his inability to deal with day-to-day life.
The difficulties of trying to live in open and free society began at that first apartment, where he had neighbors who had very loud dogs who barked, and he didn't sleep well anyway. He worked all kind of odd hours, the jobs that he worked, and in a sense, it was barking dogs that did drive him to the point of frustration that he decided to seek a remedy with guns.
But I never owned a gun before, you see, because my father never owned any real guns. He never had anything to do with them. And in fact, my father, who lives in Florida now, he was always sort of a pacifist, because he refused to hunt, he refused to fish, he never even fished. Like, he went upstate, he'd never fish because he said he couldn't stand the sight of a fish flopping around, it made him sick, you know? He was like that. And so he was opposed to violence. And so I know, what I'm trying to say, I was never raised in a home with guns, with an ample supply of guns or something, you know?
Nat had always held a heavy distaste for guns, but David certainly had no aversion to them. He loved guns, and soon he set about creating a stockpile of weapons.
How many guns did you buy?
Eventually, I had four guns.
I probably would have had more if I had the money, but I didn't have any money. Got a good shotgun cost almost $250.
When did you buy that new shotgun? What year was that?
It was in 70, the end of 74.
When did you buy the semi-automatic?
It was in 70, just about 3 months later, or 4 months later in 75. And then after that, I bought a 22 rifle. You bought a semi-automatic, you know, these rapid shots, you just keep pulling the trigger and it fires. I remember that had an 18-shot capacity. And also, in addition to this, I had a whole assortment of knives and other weapons. I had the mace, squirter, and I had an abundance of bullets.
David Berkowitz was going to war. A war against whom was the question.
But I didn't see the... At then, I was getting... You know, I didn't even see the danger signs myself then. But while I was getting angrier and angrier, my arsenal was building up. You see?
I think more than anger, it was a profound depression. And having felt he had sort of come to the end of the road really early in life, he had no ambition, and he knew that he had a very short attention span. Even though he was a quick learner, he couldn't stick with anything long enough to become an expert at it or even want to, including developing a friendship with another male or female. And I think the anger began to stir from the minor annoyances and what he perceived as rejection, which may have just been other people's way of dealing with each other. He never put in the effort to reach out, to try to find a friend or to be a friend to anyone.
Quote, "If you could hear what horrible sounds these bad dogs were making, then you could very well understand my motives, a last resort for shooting them. It was an act of desperation. You can disagree if you want, but it's true. I had tried phone calls, letters, everything, including calls to the police. Nothing, but nothing was done. I was then forced to use more extreme measures. I had no choice. Loud, excessive, or annoying noises have always been my weak point. I cannot bear these sounds, a chorus of barks, yelps, and howls, which continued throughout the day. I couldn't read, relax, sleep, or even watch the television with these intrusions. This is how bad it was. It was just too much. I never felt so hopeless, so powerless against these noisy forces in my neighborhood. I felt like worthless shit. Never would there be peace and quiet. Never would I have a real girlfriend, an intimate companionship to share my life with. I wanted these things so much, but they seemed unattainable. I couldn't please a woman or make her love me. These women are insatiable anyhow. It was all hopeless." End quote. David Berkowitz didn't have a girlfriend, a friend, or any hope of ever attaining either. So he was left alone with his limitless rage, a stockpile of weapons, and the incessant barking of the dogs chained up below his window. He had killed one of their number, and I'm sure he wouldn't have had a problem shooting the other two if it had quieted them down. But it hadn't, so there was nothing left to do but to leave. And so, with the war between David and the Dobermans being 1-0 in the dogs' favor, he took his depression and his guns and he moved upstate to escape them.
I think a combination of barking dogs and other annoyances and inability to get along with the landlord and maybe a couple of neighbors, he moved out to a more suburban area of New Rochelle and began to encounter much the same kind of annoyances that just continued to feed this fire of resentment he had for the other people and in the society where he had always felt not at home and not able to become a part of.
Act 3, New Rochelle.
I moved. I got so sick of it. I said, well, I'll move. I moved to New Rochelle, and the rent was $70 and more per month. Plus, I was twice as far from my job because I used to work in Manhattan.
So you moved from Brooklyn to New Rochelle?
I moved from the Bronx to New Rochelle into a small studio apartment in a seemingly quiet residential neighborhood, you see.
In January of 1976, David Berkowitz moved to New Rochelle, a suburb north of the city, where he rented a large furnished studio in the attic of a single-family home located at 174 Coligny Avenue. It's safe to say that the move from the city, where he had lived his entire life outside his time in the military, to the suburbs, twizzled his brain.
But, well, let me just tell you that the apartment was $70 more than in the Bronx. It was far away from any shopping center because it was in the suburbs. To just get a quart of milk, you had to take your car. When I'm used to, in my old neighborhood, the stores are right around the corner. You had the big shopping area there. You know, all these old stores, small business stores all lined up. A block of 50 different stores. You know what I mean? I used to take the subway to work, 50 cents. Never have to take my car. But when I lived in New Rochelle, I had to take my car, and it was an hour ride, a lot of gas, back and forth, see? And I gave up all those comforts just to get away from that dog, you see? So I really put a burden on myself financially because I was only working as a security guard at the time.
Run out of the city by three testy Dobermans, sleepless security guard, and dog murderer, David Berkowitz would soon discover that New Rochelle wasn't the oasis of peace and quiet he was hoping for.
When I moved to New Rochelle, I noticed two dogs in this man's yard who was going to move into in the studio apartment. But the studio apartment was on the top floor, like in an attic sort of, you know. It was really nice and roomy, but I was living up there, and he promised me that his dogs were quiet and never barked. After I moved in there and gave him $200 down for the first month's rent and $200 in advance, which he keeps until I'm ready to leave or something, he got $400 off me, and I had almost no money left. I sold all my furniture in the Bronx because this was a furnished studio apartment, you see. And then after I started living in there, I was working nights as a security guard, so I had to sleep during the day. I wouldn't get home until 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the morning. I'd just be trying to fall asleep. His dogs were not quiet by any means. They were right down below my window. They roamed around the whole big yard, barking constantly. I got no sleep, none whatsoever.
This time, it was two German shepherds. It was reported later by the landlady at New Rochelle that during David's initial visit to the apartment, he had suddenly blurted out, quote, "I don't like dogs," to which she replied, quote,
"Take it or leave it. The dogs are going to stay."
Apparently, he decided he was going to take it because he went ahead and rented the apartment, signing a 2-year lease. Although it was a decision he would come to regret almost immediately. Quote, "In the days after my job at night, I'd come home to Coligny Avenue like at 6:30 in the morning. It would begin then, the howling. On my days off, I heard it all night, too. It made me scream. I used to scream out, begging for the noise to stop. It never did. I couldn't sleep. I had no strength to fight. I could barely drive. Coming home from work one night, I almost killed myself in the car. I needed sleep. I started to fall asleep on my job. I almost got fired," end quote. And so, the situation in New Rochelle immediately went south. But it hadn't started out that way. Initially, the elderly couple Berkowitz had rented the apartment from, Jack and Nan Cassara, Jack, a 62-year-old retired mechanic, and Nan, his wife, had liked David. The latter remembering David as, quote,
"a polite young man."
And David, it seemed, felt the same way at first. Quote, "When I moved in, the Cassaras seemed very nice and quiet, but they tricked me. They lied. They said they were good people, and they were lying," end quote. Nat was gone, and David, unable to solve any of his own problems or make his own way in the world, became obsessed with the idea of finding his birth father.
His only goal had been the one since he first started thinking about who he was and where he fit in. His goal was completely internal, to discover who he was and where he had come from. And eventually that's what led him to the search of birth records at the New York City Adoption Freedom Forum. And he was a man totally lost and in search of identity. He had no idea who he was.
Maybe if he could locate his birth father, he thought, he could, in one fell swoop, replace, in some way, what he had lost and never regained when he had lost Pearl, and most recently Nat, thus providing himself with some sense of meaning, some kind of connection to the universe. In other words, he was desperate.
It was a sense of desperation to try to understand himself that drove him into a search for the people that he had been told may have been his biological parents. His biological father might be alive, the guy that he had thought might be out there looking for him when he was a child. And he thought that maybe finding this reputed biological father, he might be able to find him and develop a relationship that he could apologize for having been born and taking away the woman that this man loved, and would also give him a better idea of who he was and why he continued to be so unable to fit in.
Act 4, The Search for Tony Falco.
I wanted to locate my father to apologize to him. Because all my life I had this terror that he was going to come after me, you see. And I felt extremely guilty thinking that I had caused the death of my mother. And this was until the time I was 22 years old, you see. I still had these same feelings, although I didn't have the nightmares and things, you know. I still had all the guilt.
All his life, since being told at the age of 5 that his natural mother had died giving birth to him, David had been plagued with the idea that his natural father, consumed with grief over the death of his wife, was somewhere out there on the streets of New York City looking to find him and kill him. Now that he was a man, David wanted to find his birth father and apologize. This in his mind would forge some kind of meaningful connection with the man that would finally explain to him who he was and give him a sense of identity and purpose. To that end, David did a little research and found the Adoptees Liberty Movement Association. Quote, I called them, got an application form, and paid the membership fee of $20, end quote. The ALMA was founded in 1971 by Florence Ann Fisher and met every Tuesday at Queens College in an effort to help adopted children locate their natural parents. David Berkowitz was willing to do whatever it took to find his birth father, but he had no idea where to start, so he was hoping the ALMA would give him a place to start. Quote, I had a deep desire to know my natural family, but I had absolutely no knowledge of how I should search for my family. About a month later, I attended my first meeting in the auditorium. There were several hundred people, end quote.
After I attended the big meeting in the meeting hall, there were about 200 people there. All these people, all these adoptees looking for their families, you know, all like a bunch of lost souls. At the end of the meeting, right, we had a small workshop. The people had stayed over, and there were about 20 people in there or so, around these big tables. And they all were like, you know, telling, you know, these were for new members, to start you out as to how to go about finding your natural parents from everybody's different situations. I went in there, and they said, well, what's your name? Well, I'm David Berkowitz. I was adopted in birth. And I said, well, I'm trying to locate my goals are to locate my natural father. I don't know where he is, my biological father. I'm hoping he's alive somewhere. I would like to meet him. I didn't tell them why, but I said, well, you see, my mother died at birth while giving birth to me, and I'm trying to locate him, and they all started to kind of like laugh, you know, like, and I was like shocked. It was, what are you laughing at, you know? Well, we were all told the same thing. You understand what I'm saying? You were 20 people, we were all told the same thing. I says, you what? And then somebody said, yeah, that's what they all say. That's the end of the thing they tell you. And then somebody said, yeah, they're probably not dead. She's not dead.
He expected to receive some words of sympathy when he told the members of this adoption group that his mother had died giving birth to him, and sort of a ripple of chuckles and laughter went through the room, and he was outraged, you know, what are you laughing at? And somebody said, that's what they told all of us at that time, and he was shocked.
All my life, racked with guilt, nightmares, and trying to find my father so I could beg forgiveness for him for causing death of his wife, thinking that he was probably acting the same way my mother, my adoptive mother, did when my grandfather died, you see. They told me, no, she's alive. They tell all the adoptive parents to say that to their kids when they inquire. It's a standard line.
David had believed his birth mother to be dead his entire life. Now he found out that most likely she was alive. And let's just say he found the news to be deeply disturbing on a profound level. If his birth mother wasn't dead and was in fact very much alive, it essentially meant that his entire life, along with everything he had ever felt about himself, was all a lie.
Imagine that you had been lied to since birth. And imagine that the woman that you had gone to bed at night apologizing to God for having killed by being born was in fact living and had willingly given you up to be raised by other people.
David had never dealt well with his adoption on any level, and real or imagined, he believed that those around him had held it against him as well. In fact, he had always used his adoption as a sort of identity badge to a permanent outsider group.
This was the first time, when I was 22 years old, this was the first time I ever met anyone else who was adopted. All my life, I grew up in a neighborhood. All my friends had a lot of brothers and sisters, you know? Everybody had a brother and sister. I was the only child and the only one who was adopted. And they knew that I was adopted because the other parents used to use that as like a ridicule, you know, when I used to misbehave. And, you know, it was always because you're adopted, you're not in the same family because the other family members are good. You know, I was always like, even back then, put in the light like black sheep because the other family was always gave. My cousins, right, were always excellent students. I was just the opposite of everything they were. They were all Boy Scouts, full of boys, right? The girls were all Girl Scouts. I never had anything to do with that. I just hung out on the street, you know, made trouble with the whole in the neighborhood, you know. They were all excellent students, showing the report cards to each other, all the A's. Little angels, you know. I was a devil. I was evil, the worst one, evil. Everything they did good, I did bad. Every time they did something good, I did something bad, you know what I mean? And that's the way it went.
And after all that, everything he had gone through, the people at the ALMA were saying she probably wasn't even dead.
Finally, they explained to me in the owl place that, well, chances are your mother's probably still alive too.
This changed everything. Forget the dad. It was all about the mother now. After all, a stirring cinematic scene of apology between long-lost father and son would have been great. But a replacement for Pearl, hand-delivered to him from the cosmos, exceeded his wildest expectations. Pearl had been his everything, the center of his universe, the only person that ever deeply cared for him, and the only person to which he felt genuinely connected. She had been his only source of goodness on Earth, and even though he couldn't understand it, he could stand next to it and feel the warmth of its glow. And Pearl had only been his adoptive mother. Imagine the connection he could have with his real, live birth mother. David put a lot of stock into that daydream, and it ballooned in his heart. So with that perfect reckoning between mother and son firmly planted in his mind, David Berkowitz began in earnest to search for the woman who birthed him. It consumed his every thought.
And from that day on, I launched an all-out campaign to find her. I made it my business to find her. And every waking moment was spent thinking about her. Within about 3 or 4 months, I found her. Other people were there looking for years. They couldn't believe it. I put my mind to it. This is why I say if I put my mind to anything good, I can do it, you see. I found her in about 3 or 4 months. With the flimsiest evidence, I found her.
And David isn't wrong here. Many, if not most, of the members of the ALMA were looking for their birth parents, and many never found them. Most gave up and abandoned the search. It was a lot of work, difficult, and often unrewarding. But David felt he was up for the challenge. Frantically, desperately, he searched. From late 1974 and into 1975, he carried on night after night. After all, as he saw it, this was his one and only chance to get out of the downward spiral he was actively involved in. His last chance at a one-way ticket to normalcy. But it wasn't going to be easy. Quote, there were hundreds of ALMA who were searching too. However, I don't think very many of them sought out their roots like I did. I had totally devoted myself to that hunt. It took everything out of me and I worked around the clock. In my hunt, I divorced myself from all other cares except the basic ones. I neglected my studies and just spent my time running down leads and daydreaming what it would be like to see my natural family and what they looked like. Finding my mother was a necessity, an extreme one, that I cannot fully explain. Obviously, it was more than just locating her. It was much more. End quote. The search was everything, and he was confident it would supply him with the answers he had always been looking for. Next time on Killer Tape.
I just developed a low regard for her, you know, my biological mother. And I stopped visiting her and everything, you know, but she was always in my mind. Combined with all these other things that were happening, the frustrations at work and everything, and the job, you know, this all began to build up, you know. And at this time, the shooting started.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.